I'm Bill Barole. Over the last few decades, I've done every kind of writing there is to do, from journalism to humor, books, movies, and television.
I'm Matt Ricardo. For the last 30 years, I've toured the world as a variety performer.
Earlier this year, we came together across the Atlantic to talk about creativity, what it is, where it comes from, why it matters.
Thomas Edison said, "To invent, you need a good imagination and a pile of junk."
This is Imagination and Junk, a conversation about the hard work of creativity.
Episode 4, Stupid, Stupid Genius. Dear Bill, this morning I got up, had a can of cold Diet Coke, took my meds, made a double espresso, answered a few emails and messages while I drank it, then exercised for about 45 minutes, had a bath, made lunch first, did the dishes, and now here I sit with my second coffee of the day in my comfy chair by the window, writing. Unless I have something more pressing to do or somewhere to go, which are both deeply unlikely given the pandemic, or what last night I heard the Shopping Channel presenter strain to call, you know, all the everything going on in the world, which I thought was beautiful poetry. Anyway, so unless I have something else to do, this is how I begin every day, every single one, and have done for a while now. Partly because my mental health benefits from reliable routine, it helps me think I'm in charge of my world, but partly because my thinking is that even if I get nothing else done, at least I started the day with some exercise, and the nice little dopamine bump I get from that means there's more chance I might get something done. I'm very much in the Octavia Butler camp here. She said, "Forget inspiration, habit is more dependable." Haruki Murakami starts every day by getting up at 4 a.m, doing 6 hours of writing, then going for a 10k run and a 1500 meter swim. But that's nothing compared to Victor Hugo, who would begin each day by being woken up by a gunshot from a nearby fort, reading a letter from his mistress, eating 2 raw eggs, and then, and I swear this is true, taking a bath on his roof in ice-cold water that had been left out all night in public. David Lynch, however, goes to Bob's Big Boy, has a chocolate shake and 7 cups of coffee, and then borrows the waitress's pen to write on napkins. I once won a Bob's Big Boy shirt in a competition, so I feel more attuned to his way of doing things than the whole bath on the roof thing. But whatever works, right? As we get into our stride as people who make things for a living, we find the routines and habits that help motivate us to actually create. We have to, especially once the creating is what's paying the rent. As I've mentioned already, I cut my teeth as a street performer, and those years taught me the benefits of self-imposed rules and routines. The great thing about being a busker is the freedom. You work when you want, no boss, it's all down to you. The bad thing is the freedom. It's all down to you. So pretty quickly I realized that if the core of what I'm doing is so loose, then I'd better surround it with structure so that it works. But it feels like you went the opposite way. At Newsweek, you were slotted into a very strict hierarchy of bosses, deadlines, and expectations. So, did this have an effect on how you approach your own motivation? Do you need to be awoken by a gunshot? You live in LA, so it's probably something you could arrange. I use both carrot and stick. After I finish writing this, I'll reward myself with a video game. Like Charles Darwin, I try to schedule at least 1 hour a day for, and I'm quoting directly here, idleness. But I've also found that gratitude helps. I try to keep connected to how lucky I am to be able to do all the things I've listed in my morning routine. If the teenage me could see the middle-aged me sitting here writing a script for a podcast while a video I made slowly uploads to YouTube, I think he'd be pretty pleased. So yeah, that's a motivator. I feel I have some kind of obligation, maybe? I'm scared that might make me sound awful and precious, but screw it. Anyway, I hope you're finding your hour a day for idleness. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, fine. I'll see your pocket histories of famous guys who were more productive than Bill, and I'll raise you a couple of quotes. Because, as we established in an earlier episode, quoting the deep thoughts of famous thinkers is a great way to seem like one, without having to do all of that taxing brain work. So, Duke Ellington, who was no slouch when it came to creativity, said, "I don't need more time. What I need is a deadline." On the other hand, Douglas Adams, also a highly creative and productive individual, said, "I love deadlines. I like the whooshing sound they make as they fly by." I am, as you may be able to guess from these, a creature of deadlines. But not necessarily in a good way. Let me explain. You're correct that I was, at Newsweek, a cog in a machine. There was structure above and below me, and a rigid weekly schedule. It would have been impossible to produce the magazine without it, impossible to coordinate reporting from all over the world, with writers primarily based in New York, and put out a product that landed on newsstands like clockwork every Monday morning. Above all, there was the deadline. The week had a rising rhythm, and it aimed squarely at Friday night's editorial close, which was the hard out on the week, because the presses were definitely going to roll at the printing plants in New York, Virginia, Wisconsin, Arkansas, and California on Saturday. And they were going to roll with you or without you. The deadline was inflexible, and it was inviolable. Weirdly, maybe, I have warm feelings for the deadline. I love, first of all, the sound of it. I mean, it is, before all else, just an extremely cool word. Its origins are murky, but it's thought to date back to the Civil War, where it referred to a line that a prisoner couldn't cross without being shot, which sort of puts the wrath of an angry editor in perspective. By the early years of the 20th century, the term had passed into broader usage, and here it connects guys like me to the romantic, hard-bitten days of newspapering, days when reporters kept bottles of rye in their desks and always wore fedoras. I had a fedora in my office at Newsweek as a nod toward those days, but I rarely wore it, because I don't have a head for hats, which I'm pretty sure is a thing no ink-stained 1940s city desk guy ever even thought of saying. I also had a pair of pink satin bunny ears. This is true. I had a pair of pink satin bunny ears I'd gotten at a place downtown in what remained of the old novelty shop district. I'm telling you, New York was the place to be in the 1980s. And for a time, I ritually wore them as a mood lightener when I was banging away on a deadline. In case you wonder why my bosses didn't always take me seriously. Beyond the sound of it, though, and the history of it, there was, in practical terms, something comforting about Newsweek's rigid deadline. It gave you a way to propel yourself smoothly through the week. It told you when to send your queries to correspondents in the field, when to start badgering them to file their reporting to New York, when to begin absorbing and organizing it, and when to close the door and begin writing. It had other uses, too. It let you time out for maximum efficiency, if you so chose. How long to delay starting work on a story you didn't like, before you wandered into your editor's office and told her casually but sadly that you didn't think the thing was working out. This was the most effective known technique to sandbag a story in weekly journalism. There was an art to it. You had to balance your objection right on the fulcrum of the week, right at the point where there was not quite enough time to order up more reporting, and just enough time before the deadline to plug in something that might have been held from the previous week. It was one of the tricks of the trade. So the deadline was central to the life of a Newsweekly writer in a number of ways, and its influence on me continued long after I left Newsweek. This is the part of the story about how early exposure to deadlines ruined me as a freelancer. You pointed out, quite accurately, that when you're your own boss, success or failure is, as they say in tennis, on your racket. I left Newsweek at the dawn of the 90s to work for a while as a sitcom writer, also a deadline business. But then I began a long period of self-employment, first in freelance print journalism and then in online journalism, and then in movies and books and eventually podcasting. And the truth is, if I'm honest, that I've never really accommodated to a flexible schedule. Without the hard, clean fact of the deadline to sight on, the period leading up to delivering a project or an assignment can get woozy. It can shapeshift, like in a dream. And it becomes all too easy to procrastinate. You talked about reserving an hour a day for idleness. My reaction when I heard that was, only an hour? This kind of discipline has, I'm afraid, eluded me throughout my self-employment. Even when I was doing my first podcast, Home, Stories from L.A., I eventually succumbed to a draggy inertia that slowed my release schedule from every other week to every 3 weeks, and then four. This is so common in podcasting that the phenomenon has a name: podfade. So let's try not to do that. This is where discipline comes into play, to be sure. I think you're right that habit is a way we enforce discipline on ourselves. It may not be the best way. Strength of character is probably the best way, but maybe that's the sound of me judging myself. Anyway, it's a good way. The trick is turning habit to your advantage, though, isn't it? Rather than letting it act to your detriment. My habits, I've realized, don't tilt along the axis of productivity. Just the opposite, in fact. They're all about delay, about forestalling the moment when excuse is exhausted and it's time to face the blank page. I'm not scapegoating, but the internet has a lot to answer for in this regard. I wonder, is it possible to become physically addicted to those micro jolts of dopamine you get from likes, retweets, and shares? That's a powerful Jones. By the way, you may have noticed that it's taken me a week to get you this response to your previous segment. It isn't that I was screwing around on Twitter, you understand, or watching first-person walking tours of Tokyo on YouTube. I mean, I was, but it was research. Research! I hope you're filling your time there at least as productively as I am here. And really, for your sake, more so. Take care. Bill.
Dear Bill, I have a couple of fedoras, also some pork pies, newsboys, and a bunch of others. Some, in fact, bought from the wonderful Hollywood hat store in your own town. I have a grey fedora that I used for a cabaret piece that I got in that shop, and when I took it to the desk to pay for it, the guy who runs the place nodded approvingly and said, "Oh yeah, that's the one Leonard Cohen used to come in to buy." Which, regardless of whether it's true or not, is A-plus sales technique. People with my hairstyle, which is to say not much of it at all, often get into hats pretty quickly. Although I did once get told by somebody that I was arguing with on Twitter that my opinion was invalid because I was wearing a fedora in my profile picture. I told him that it was actually a stingy brim trilby, but by then I think he'd blocked me. Anyway, after our segue into the world of wrestling last time out, let's try not to let this become a podcast about middle-aged men discussing hats. Although, honestly, I totally think there'd be an audience for that. Pretty much the entirety of my professional and creative life doesn't involve any kind of deadline, which means I have to impose them myself. I've known too many talented and skilled creatives who thought that would be enough and seemed to wait for the universe to recognize their genius and reward them, which, of course, often didn't happen. When I first started performing, it was a dream come true just to have the chance to do it. It still is, but in a slightly different way. Back then, the feeling of excitement at trying to entertain an audience was everything to me. Also, it was everything to me, in that I had pretty much nothing else in my life except that, so I did it whenever I could. For the first couple of years of my performing life, if it wasn't raining, then you would have found me trying to get laughs out of strangers on the streets of London. Covent Garden, Chinatown, the South Bank, Greenwich, any place with enough space to pull a circle of people, I'd give it a try. So I guess deadlines were made redundant by a psychotically driven work ethic. These days, I give myself deadlines for completing tasks. Today, one of the things on my to-do list was to write this piece. And look, here I am, sitting in my comfy chair with the window open, banging away on my laptop like a cat in a gif. My dad, who wasn't the most encouraging father of his son's artistic career, often called me lazy. I don't think he saw what I do as work. But as things parents say often do, that stuck in my head throughout my life. So I set deadlines, I make to-do lists, I work hard, and the more I do that, the more my job feels like an actual grown-up thing, and less the silly childishness that my father seemed to think it was. It's nice having no boss, being a long-term freelancer. There's an adventurous freedom there. I love that I never know what craziness the next gig might bring or where it might take me. But with that freedom comes a pressure to keep forward motion. I'm continually hustling, trying to keep myself in the minds of people who might have a use for me and finding new places that my work might fit into. Because in my business, if you don't keep up that momentum, you might sink pretty quickly. Sometimes it's exhausting, constantly selling a commodified version of myself while making sure you don't lose the quirky bits of humanity that actually serve to make you interesting. But you can't beat the feeling of landing a nice gig. Somebody wants me? And they'll give me this month's mortgage money to have me? Yes, please and thank you. At the time of recording this, we're still in the middle of the pandemic, so all that hectic showbiz hustle has pretty much just stopped. And I miss the gigs and the travel and the fun of doing shows, of course, but I don't really miss all the stuff I have to do to get those things. And if I'm honest, I'm a little scared that as things slowly, fingers crossed, start to open back up, I might not have that hunger to get myself out there. For the last year, my creativity has been mostly unlucrative, but undeniably more pure. I've been making things just to make them, because I have nothing much else to do until my industry comes out of hibernation. So, will I find shifting gears back into work mode tricky? I guess the world is going to start giving me deadlines on that pretty soon, so I better get a new to-do list written to get me there. Today, here in Southend, England, it feels like spring. My window is open, the sky is blue, birds are literally singing, and there's a nice breeze coming in. I hope LA is starting to feel like winter might be on its way out too. Talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, I found myself nodding at your Leonard Cohen story. It's a variant of the way guys in stereo stores used to try to close the deal by telling you confidentially that this is the very system they have in their own homes, crossed with an LA phenomenon that, for me, reached its peak when Jennifer and I were looking for a place to get married. The way it works is, none of the proprietors of these joints is gauche enough to say, look, you really want to have your wedding here because last year, we hosted both Dolph Lundgren and Melissa Rivers. No, they just hand you a huge loose leaf binder full of wedding pictures and silently withdraw. We were at a venue overlooking the beach near Malibu, and I was flipping through their giant binder, and it was like the 30th place we'd looked at, and my head was starting to swim, and I turned a page and stopped and pointed to a photo and said to Jennifer in a sort of a sneering way, ugh, look at this jerk who thinks he's Bob Dylan. Jennifer peered at the photo for a moment and finally said, that is Bob Dylan. We didn't get married there, but I have to admit, it made an impression. Oh, also, being told on Twitter that your opinion is invalid because you're wearing a certain kind of hat is maybe the second most Twitter thing I've ever heard. The most Twitter thing I've ever heard is that the guy misidentified the hat. One difference between us, I think, I mean, besides our vastly different abilities to rock a stingy brim trilby, is that, as we've now seen, I had habit and routine imposed on me early in my working life, and you never did. Just the opposite, in fact. It sounds like you realized from the very start that you were going to have to make your own. I'd argue that this makes you better qualified for a creative life over the long haul than I'll ever manage to be, because the story of the arts over the last few decades has been that the infrastructures which have always propped up creative careers have, in Eddie Izzard's memorable formulation, collapsed like a flan in the sun. We've seen this happen in virtually every form of creative life since the 70s, from journalism to music to cinema. That turn toward a DIY aesthetic has altered virtually every old creative industry and made whole new ones possible, like, for instance, podcasting. Guys like me haven't been excluded from that transition, but we have had to adapt ourselves to it. A busker, though, may be, in a funny way, the person most naturally equipped to navigate it. You travel light, meet the people where they are, literally make your own stages. Even when your career advances to the point where you start playing theaters and festivals, as yours did, you can still, and always, take it back to the streets. You talked about, early on in your career, deadlines being made redundant for you by what you called your psychotically driven work ethic. Well, you call it that. I called it strength of character in my last segment. Potato, potato, I guess. However you define it, though, as a flaw or a virtue, that capacity to self-start is key, because absent all of that scaffolding, and it is increasingly absent, more and more of us are freelancers, in fact, if not in name. The pressure you identified to keep up forward momentum is real, and I think it's felt most keenly among those of us who serve as our own bosses, because another way to say that every day is potentially a day off is to say that there really are no days off. Or, paradoxically, if you really want to slice the metaphor wafer thin, that the only way to have days off that you can fully inhabit is to create them, and the only way to do that is by honoring the work days. Being a writer, Lawrence Kasdan said, and this is true for every kind of solo operator, is like having homework every night for the rest of your life. You wondered if the transition back to your normal work life will be jarring. I suspect it will, but I'd also suspect that you'll have less trouble getting back into that groove than some of us, precisely because you've been deliberately continuing to make things right through lockdown. Creativity is a muscle, and habit and routine are the weights we use to work it out. But let me give you the benefit of my meager experience as a podcaster. If you think a life as a show business free agent is a hustle, brother, wait until you get a load of podcasting. One side effect of that democratization I was talking about, the DIY thing that made it possible for every person with a keyboard to be a publisher and for everyone with a mic to be a broadcaster, is that when everyone can do it, everyone will do it. And your job, or a significant part of it, then becomes pushing your version of it to the surface. There are approximately 10 zillion podcasts that consist of two white guys sitting around talking, which, after all, is exactly what this is. You and I might believe that the talents and experiences we bring to this podcast inform it with something special, but that doesn't mean we don't have to prove it with every new episode. And if that doesn't impose discipline on our process, I promise you, nothing will. It is indeed spring here in Los Angeles. The tree outside my office window, the one that I'm absolutely 100% sure goes fully dead every winter, not dormant, but dead, has started to push out little purple flowers. Because nature's ability to refresh itself and start again is astonishing, even when you don't believe in it. This is a lesson I seem to have to learn over and over, and it has a little extra resonance this year. I hope that your to-do lists for this spring once again include getting on trains and planes and boats to go meet the people where they are. I'll talk to you soon. Bill.
Dear Bill, your mention of Eddie Izzard gives me all the permission I need to be this guy. In the late 80s, I shared a street performing pitch with Eddie for a little while. Eddie was then, and remains, a singularly funny person, a delightful human, and as motivated as you could imagine anyone to be. Her street show, back then, involved all the surreal silliness you'd expect. My favourite part was when she'd introduce a tea cosy shaped like a penguin. Do you Americans even know what a tea cosy is? It's a padded decorative sleeve designed to slip over a teapot and keep the tea warm. As I say it, it does seem the most Little England thing in the history of my island, but it is a real thing, I promise. Anyway, Eddie had one that looked like a penguin. She would announce that it was an Australian boomerang penguin which would always return when thrown. And then she'd throw it over the heads of the audience far out into the street around her show. And she'd keep talking loudly about how it would always come back because it's a Australian boomerang penguin tea cosy. So it will always come back because it's an Australian boomerang penguin tea cosy until somebody walking past would see it, pick it up and throw it back. It was genius. Stupid, stupid genius. You're right about street performers being flexible. The last time I saw Eddie was when I chatted to her on camera for one of my shows. We reminisced about our time working the same piazza, and she said that the first time she played the Hollywood Bowl at rehearsal, she looked out from the stage and immediately drew from the skill set learned from the street. According to Eddie, being a good street performer showed her how to be good on that stage too. Eddie has occasionally popped up to play with an old friend in their street show too. It feels like she still wants to make sure that, if need be, she can still do it. I'm feeling the same way. People are starting to get vaccinated here, so plans are slowly being made by the rusty clown car of my government to open things back up, which means that gigs are starting to appear in my diary for a few months down the road. We've been talking about how habit and routine keep our creative lives chugging along, and although during lockdown I've been making things in a whole new way for a whole new medium. So that has brought with it a whole new set of routines for writing, shooting, editing. But the habits that help keep everything together as a live performer, well, I haven't done those in a while. I'm hopeful, though, that once I get closer to those gigs, my collection of pre-show ticks will make sure that I'm moving in the right direction. That's what routines are for, right? Partly to make sure you're remembering to do all the things you need to do, and partly odd little things you always do because they're things you always do. I have a friend, a famous comedian, who, because of his job, drives a lot. When he slides behind the wheel of his car, he does all the usual pre-flight checks, and then he says a little message, the same every time, to the car, which has a second part, which, if I'm in the seat next to him, I am expected to say. And then he kisses the steering wheel and is ready to go. He knows it's silly, but it's what he does. I have to pack my suitcase a certain way, not really because of superstition, but because it's the best way to pack my case, but also it feels nice knowing everything is packed correctly, efficiently, safely, the same way it always is. At my sound check, I'll recite the first verse of a Public Enemy song, and then just before I go out on stage, I'll be bouncing on the balls of my feet in the wings. I'll check my zip, and then I'll pretend to see my old friend Jay, smile at where he would be if he were there, and then off onto stage I go. I'm not superstitious, and I don't think that disaster would befall me if I didn't do any of these things, and I'm sure I do a dozen more things that I'm unaware of, but I just happen to usually do them, so they're what I do. They're the little messages that my body sends to my subconscious, telling it that I'm going to do that thing, where there's loud noises and bright lights and lots of chemicals fizz into my brain for 20 minutes or so, but it's okay, we've done this before, we know what this is. So much of routine and habit is finding the stuff that reminds you that you know what you're doing and that you're fully able to do it, because sometimes you might not think that's true. The weather here has been disturbingly nice. We went for a long walk through fields and farmland and hills, ending up at a beach yesterday. When we got home, we both noticed we'd got a little sunburned. That didn't feel bad at all. Talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, I saw Eddie Izzard at the Hollywood Bowl, and one of the things that struck me then, as it did the other times I've seen her, in smaller and less intimidating surroundings, was her confidence. I don't know if she's a confident person, but knowing she was a street performer, it's easy to see how staring down a crowd that's only accidentally an audience is a skill that's translatable to any venue anywhere. Or, for that matter, just to life. You talked in an earlier episode about how learning to act like a confident grown-up on stage helped you become one in the offstage world. Act as if you have faith and faith will be given to you, right? By the way, I've seen that line attributed to both the Jesuits and David Mamet, which is hilarious. I enjoyed that peek behind the curtain at your pre-show rituals, and I don't doubt that they'll help shape and smooth your re-entry into live performing. It stands to reason that they would. As for me, I've never yet found the combination of rubbing my head and patting my stomach that makes me a better organized, more productive writer, or simply gets me in the right groove. I have things that help keep the sputtering Vespa of my concentration on the road, but even those can serve as distractions if you want badly enough to be distracted. Tell me if this sounds familiar. You know what I need? I need a Pomodoro timer. I'm going to spend half a day researching Pomodoro timers to find out which is the best Pomodoro timer. It may be that I just have a short attention span, and keeping it on task is a frantic improvisation, like trying to pluck monkeys from the air. The kind of energy-intensive free-for-all that's going to take everything you have, exhaust you, and piss off the monkeys. So it may well be that my process would benefit from a little rigor. And your fidelity to your habits has me thinking about ones I might adopt in the aftertimes. One thing about a species-level event like a pandemic, it distorts your sense of time by focusing you on a sort of never-ending now. Quick, tell me without looking at your watch. What day is today? I know, right? I suspect that when we all settle back into something like our regular lives, we'll be looking for ways to make the long now of lockdown have meant something. Ways to improve who we are and what we do. And maybe most of all, ways to reframe how we manage time. So I'm going to come up with some ideas. You know, eventually. I hope those gigs penciled into your diary get inked before too long. And who knows? Maybe someday soon we'll be meeting for an in-person, non-distanced, post-show cocktail. I hope so. Until then, take care. Bill. Imagination and Junk is written by Bill Barole in the U.S. and Matt Ricardo in the U.K., with audio production by Bill Barole. For more information, show notes, and bonus content, it's imaginationandjunk.com.